The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
In daily life, I found for myself that using these as lenses isn't just helpful in the cushion, but it can actually support companionship and nurture more of a healthy attitude towards relationships and healthy relationships themselves, both with myself and with the people in my life, especially perhaps in a single person's life, whether you are single by choice or loss or happenstance. So what do I mean by cultivating conditions? There's a lot of teachings on conditionality in the early Buddhist suttas, scriptures, but one of the most prevalent is the simplest, and it goes something like this. When this arises, that comes to be. When this ceases, that ceases. It's just that simple. And in reality, it is that simple sometimes, as far as proximate causes, immediate causes goes, but it's also a little bit more complicated, right? It's more like a web, an interdependent matrix, or like a garden or agriculture. There's all these different conditions that can bring one thing to fruition. So what kinds of things bring metta to fruition? What do the early suttas have to say about that? One of the things they say very clearly is wise choice of companionship. So it helps to generate metta if you are surrounded by people for whom metta comes naturally. Now, that is, of course, not always the case in our lives, even back in the Buddha's day. But beginning to be discerning about who one spends time with can be a helpful first condition, especially for those of us who are single and we might not be in long-term familial relationships or partnerships, we might have a little bit more choice than others. I'm going to say a little bit here from the suttas about this. Here's another condition. The Buddha comes up to a couple of monks in a grove, two or three who are dwelling together. And he asks them how they're doing. It's actually a really caring conversation. You know, do you have enough food? Do you have a place to sleep? Are you doing okay? That kind of conversation. Are you getting along? And they respond, surely, yes, we're living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, and viewing each other with kindly eyes. Isn't that sweet? Kindly eyes. So that, to my mind, that's one of the key conditions for metta is appreciation, mutual appreciation, and cultivating a sense of appreciation. There's a few others that are listed further in this sutta, and I'm not going to keep reading it because it's a little bit archaic, but consideration for the other, respect for the intentions and efficacy of that other person or people. And perhaps most importantly, a sense of trust. If not trust for another, then trust in one's own intentions. To tap into that higher intention or deeper intention that you might have in your own heart. Buddhist love also can take the form of compassion. And I'm not really going to talk about karuna tonight, the Pali word, which is more of a meditative state that we arrive at. I'm going to speak about the other one, anukampa, which is the trembling of the heart for the welfare of others. It's actually kind of a literal translation. It's a movement of the heart. What are the conditions for compassion? Well, one, unfortunately, is difficulty, right? mine, yours, someone else's. That's a condition. But that's not the only condition. Another condition is being willing to see difficulty, to meet it in myself, or to meet it in that neighbor who is having a hard time with a broken leg, or the fellow on the street who's not doing so well. That willingness to notice is also a matter of intention, right? And again, consideration, a certain kind of openness to the experience of other. One of the real benefits I've found of compassion in my own life was really a surprise to me. A few years ago, I embarked on this training, this master's degree in chaplaincy, and about the same time, I started volunteering at San Francisco General, which is the main trauma center and holding hospital for all of those who have basically no insurance. So a lot of folks from difficult walks of life. And one evening, after a particularly long shift, I found myself at Trader Joe's on the way home, shopping. And I was surprised to notice that it was almost like each person I saw in the grocery store had a little glow around them. And I realized it wasn't them. It was this feeling of compassion that had just informed what I was seeing. Now, I'm not like this all the time, but meeting the suffering of people for several hours at a time actually brought this elevation, this curious kind of beauty to interactions with others. So it has tremendous potential in our lives. It's also really important for me personally to meet my own difficult states when I'm alone with compassion. I might not have anyone right there to be with me, to help. And sometimes that compassion looks like reaching out and allowing someone else to exercise their compassion, right? Third kind of Buddhist love is mudita, empathetic joy. And there is a lot of kinds of joy actually listed in early Buddhism, which surprised me a little bit. I didn't think of joy as being a big emphasis. And it's not, but it's in there. There's the joy of freedom, of release. There's the joy of seclusion. There's joyful interest. But mudita is a special kind of joy, empathetic joy. And its conditions are actually kind of built into the other translations. It is also known as appreciative joy, altruistic joy. And the altruism and the appreciation both describe that kind of joy, and they also are results. The joy results from those activities, right? It can, especially if one takes the time to reflect on the joy itself. There's another benefit as well. This, again, this is a sutta that describes the Buddha talking to his son, Rahula. And he's talking about different meditations Rahula can do. Rahula, develop meditation on altruistic joy. For when you develop meditation on altruistic joy, discontent will be abandoned. It's kind of a nice benefit. What are some of the other conditions? I think for me, when altruistic joy comes up, it is a sign that I'm not so locked into my little, separate, solid, self-centered view of self. That there's the possibility of looking at another person's good fortune, another person's health, another person's well-being, and actually delighting in it. And that requires a certain kind of generosity of heart. There's a big benefit to it in relationship, though. A person expressing this kind of joy, you may have noticed, is a delight to be around. You notice that? The people in your life who really appreciate when you're happy, they're kind of nice to be with. And it's infectious. It can spread and resonate. So these three forms, loving kindness or benevolence, compassion, empathetic joy, I think all of them, to me, have kind of obvious benefits in daily life, in relational life, in our life with others in the world. And one of those has to do a little bit with what I was just talking about with infectiousness. I think Rumi says this really well. This is from a poem called With That Moon Language. Admit something. Everyone you see, you say to them, love me. Of course, you don't do this out loud. Otherwise, someone would call the cops. Still, think about it. This great pull in us to connect. We all have it. Why not become the one who lives with a full moon in each eye? That's always saying with that sweet moon language what every other eye in the world is longing to hear. And the last, equanimity. A couple of my teachers, including Gil, call this grandparent love. It's the kind of love that when the kid falls off the bike, the parent might freak out, but the grandparent, they know it's going to be okay. It's love without quite so much worry, caught up in this, a little bit more space, settled back. And I guess I can really only speak for myself in daily life to the conditions that bring equanimity about. And the biggest one is trust. Trust in the process. Trust that somehow things will work themselves out. Trust in my own good intentions, or at least in my own capacity to develop good intentions. And then the other big condition is having a sense of the big picture, a larger view, right? Upekkha, equanimity, one of the literal translations is to look over, as in looking from a high place over a landscape. It's a lot easier to have equanimity in that when it's a bigger view. This has come clear to me in the last, 6, 7 years when female friend after female friend has dropped off the face of the earth for 2 to 5 years due to pregnancy and childbirth. And the first couple of times it was really kind of jarring and painful even to have those female friendships just kind of vanish or radically change. And then the big picture began to emerge. The big picture of the joy in their lives, of course, was already there, but also the longer view. It is only 2 to 5 years, after all, then they come back. Or not. Other people come in. That's the other thing about equanimity, is it both engenders and helps us to see, and we can help have it, by noticing anicca, the constant process of change and impermanence and flux in this interdependent web of relationships. Holistic sense of interdependence that comes. Anicca, you might try it as well. Maybe you already do. Trusting that leads to a sense of self-sufficiency, internal sufficiency that doesn't need quite as much from outside. In that sense, I think all of the forms of Buddhist love, but equanimity in particular, can become a wisdom practice. And that helps develop not just a more spacious way of relating to relationships and life, but also the path as well, right? So I hope these reflections help spark some ideas about how you might cultivate greater love and nourishment in your own lives through the Buddhist lens. Let's sit for just a minute before we do Q&A.